You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey, everyone. So today I have the pleasure of speaking with Terrence Doyle. Now, if you've listened to our podcast on the Opportunity Zone from a couple months ago, then you've already met and heard Terrence. Now, in terms of the interview today, this is actually the second time that I sat down with Terrence to record this, because many months ago, we sat down and recorded it. It was a good podcast, but for various reasons, the publishing date kept getting delayed. And then we were ready to publish it. I went back and listened to it. And I just wanted to re-record it for a couple reasons. One is because Terrence and I have become better friends. We got a better dynamic now. And his investing business has also evolved as well. So, and I realized, hey, I could publish it, it'd be good, but if we sat down and redo it, it'd be better. So Terrence and I decided to sit down and redo it. So here is version 2.0, the remix. And so about Terrence before we dive into it, in about 2014, he started his current real estate investing business here in Denver. And since then, he's completed well over 100 flips. He owns a rental portfolio of like 200 plus units in Des Moines, Iowa. He owns property here in Denver. And now he's done a bunch of single family flips. His focus has shifted to some multifamily stuff. And as far as I know, out of all the investors I've talked with, he's the only person that's not just talking about opportunity zones, but is actively buying and developing opportunity zones. So he is someone that's moving and shaking around Denver. So Terrence, welcome to the show, man.
Chris, thanks for having me a second time. Excited about the remix we're doing here.
Good. And so before we jump into all the real estate investing stuff, I actually want to take everyone back a few steps, I guess we'd say a few years, and talk about your story from, you know, what you did in college with some franchising and sports agencies, and then how you pivoted and used those skills and what you learned to get into real estate. Because, I mean, I get people all the time asking me, hey, how can I get into real estate? How can I do things? And, you know, you're a poster child example of what you did, how you executed on it. So I just want to kind of walk you through that so people can benefit from there. So start from the beginning.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I've, like you said, at the beginning, I've really enjoyed getting to know you. I'm really impressed with everything you're building here and, you know, really thankful and humbled to be back on. You know, the first thing at the beginning is I feel really fortunate because I had two amazing parents that were both immigrants. My dad was from Canada. My mom is from South America. She's from a country called Colombia. And I think that I would definitely not be here, you know, without their support and just all the time and resources they invested into me. I think my mom doesn't really speak that great of English. My dad doesn't have a college education. And yet somehow they found a way for me to go to a private high school. They helped me go to a private Christian college that allowed me to be where I'm at today. So I think, you know, a lot of things we don't get to choose in life. You don't get to choose your parents. And I was really fortunate that I had two amazing parents and that helped me a lot. Like you said, in college, I had the opportunity to play college basketball. I was on scholarship. One of my college teammates, my junior year, was studying franchising and was really interested in that. He, a year later, came to me and another buddy and said, hey, I think I want to start franchising this business that I'm working for. It happened to be a carpet cleaning company. And so we started a company called OxyFresh Carpet Cleaning. This was in 2006, which makes me feel very old. 2006 sounds like a long time ago. Anyways, that was the year, 2006. And by 2008, we had well over 100 franchise units around the country.
Were you still in college in 2008?
No, I had graduated in 2006.
Okay.
So the year that I graduated is the year we started. He was a little bit older. He'd been out of college for a few years. And I was really fortunate. He was a visionary. It was my first taste in entrepreneurship. Like I said, my dad did not have a college degree. He's been working at the same company for 35 years. My mom was a full-time mom. So I knew nothing about entrepreneurship. And it was a great learning experience. We had some success. We sold a bunch of franchises. I owned my own franchise with my dad and my brother in Des Moines, Iowa. And it was a blast. We learned a ton. During that time, I had a chance to work for the Denver Nuggets. When I was in college, I did an internship with them. Two of my really close friends played professionally in the NBA. So I was an entrepreneur. I had some background in sports, and I had some really close friends that were playing professional basketball. And so I saw an opportunity to basically take my experience as an entrepreneur and kind of apply that to if you're a professional athlete, what other opportunities could there be because you're famous in a city? There might be some opportunities for business.
Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah. So basically, you know, let's say that, you know, like Shaquille O'Neal, for example, when he was coming, when he was first in the NBA, when Amazon had first started, I think he was able to buy shares of Amazon pre-IPO because he was a famous basketball player and they wanted him to help them raise money for an early stage round. The same thing has happened in New York when Carmelo Anthony got traded from the Denver Nuggets. He was in New York. He got invited to be part of this fund. One of their first investments was Lyft. And, you know, Carmelo Anthony got shares of Lyft early on for being Carmelo Anthony. So it was ideas like that. I thought that there was an opportunity to arbitrage basically fame from athletes into early stage opportunities, whether it be a tech company or an office building or a franchise. So I just thought, and that still goes on today. I mean, you look at Peyton Manning when he was in the Denver Broncos, you know, he got shares, I think, in a brewing company. He also got shares in Papa John's. You look at Tom Brady, he's gotten shares, part of a shoe deal with Under Armour. You know, so this happens all the time. I just thought that there was an opportunity to kind of scale that. And this was back in 2008 and 9. So we started a sports agency based on that. So we, you know, kind of managing their careers and helping them negotiate their contracts and thinking outside the box. And so that was my full-time kind of job from 2009 to 2014 was I was a full-time sports agent. I had liquidated everything that I'd made in OxyFresh and we had sold our franchise and my position at the company in Denver. And it was a wild ride. It was very, very difficult. Anybody that's been in the business of sports, either working for a team, working for a university sports department, or working directly for athletes knows it's extremely competitive, extremely difficult. And that was a wild ride. In there, we actually as well owned a professional team in Spain. And that was very complicated as well. Doing international business has its own set of complications. So all that to say, I had a lot of failures along the way, and it was an incredible ride, but very difficult.
Now, something I know about just because we've been friends for a while now is that, I guess it was one of your partners or someone involved in your sports industry business, they were kind of running a real estate division that was doing fix and flips or something, and that you weren't really involved in that, but as you put it, you were kind of on the sideline around it, and that's what got you interest in real estate, right?
Yeah. So I believe the year was 2007. I had made a couple bucks from the company I was a part of, OxyFresh. And this was right when foreclosures were just starting to become popular in the country because of all the distressed assets, right at the beginning of the recession. And he came to me and said, hey, we're going to start buying foreclosures at the Denver Public Trustee sale, the auction. Would you want to be an investor? And I believe I was one of their first, second, or third investors. I remember we bought a house for around $60,000 at the Denver Public Trustee sale. And I believe we sold it 3 or 4 weeks later for 90 something. And that was my first taste in real estate. At the time I was a renter. I didn't even own a home. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And so that we did end up forming a company together. I helped my role then. I didn't understand anything about real estate. My role was just to connect the capital. So I helped introduce some capital relationships. I also had some relationships around the country of other guys that were flipping properties that needed capital. And so I was able to introduce some operators to the company. But during that time, I did not understand real estate, I didn't know real estate. I just kind of connected the dots and made introductions, and I didn't understand real estate. But that is how we made the sports thing, never made money. Real estate from those years did. You know, we ended up from 2008 to 2014, I think we flipped and sold maybe 600 single family homes around the country, primarily in Denver. I was not a big part of that. Like I said, I just connected the capital and was kind of on the sidelines.
And so you got out of the sports agency business in 2014. And then you and your current business partner, Brandon, who was also on the Opportunity Zone podcast, you guys started a new business on what you're currently doing now. So kind of tell the story about that, on how you just hustled and networked and learned, because like, as you said, you knew real estate was profitable. You knew that was a place to focus, but you really didn't know what to do per se. So how'd you say, hey, great, real estate can make a ton of money. How'd you go from doing that to now, you know, doing dozens of flips a year and now doing multifamily stuff?
Yeah. The first thing was, most good things come when we either get engaged or married, and when a woman says, hey, you need to get a real job. So that is what happened to me. I got engaged. My wife was very encouraging about, hey, why don't we find something that's a little more stable, something we can count on. And I always knew that we had made money at real estate. And so I knew that I figured I could find a way to make that work. So I moved back to Denver. At the time, I was living in LA and Las Vegas, and I moved back to Denver full time. And I had some good mentors around me that were able to give me some structure and some guidelines. But it really came down to, I wanted to meet as many people that were doing real estate and take them to coffee or lunch and ask them as many questions as I could. And, you know, I remember emailing, I remember being at networking events, getting 10 business cards and going home that night and emailing every real estate agent or lender and just saying, hey, can I take you to coffee? Can I take you to lunch? I just want to know about the market. I want to know what you think the best areas are. I want to know what makes the best, you know, where do you see opportunity? What should I be doing? What should I be focusing on? And really just asking a bunch of questions, taking a bunch of notes and trying to learn the process from A to Z. That was my mentality every day, was I want to learn. I want to get around people that are doing this. I want to see what they're doing well, what they're not doing well, what I could do that they're doing, and what people I need to bring around me that are good at the things that I'm not. So that was really how it all started. I, like I said, I had been a part of 600, but I didn't know the process. So I, you know, I learned from, you know, the step one, just being able to like comp a property. When someone sends me an address, how do I find out what the right price is for that? You know, to walking it with GCs, you know, how do I figure out what the budget's going to be? How do I protect myself from getting screwed in a construction agreement with a GC? To, you know, what kind of finishes should we do? You know, when to list a property, who to list it with, what price point, you know, that whole, the whole process of buying a property, figuring out if it's a flip or a rental. So it just came from spending a lot of time with people that knew more than me and that had more experience and that were willing to just spend the time to kind of teach me.
And I mean, how many paid seminars and paid coaching groups did you go to? How many Fortune Builders events did you go to? How much did you pay for?
Yeah, I probably paid for maybe 50 lunches and 100 coffees, but I didn't pay for any seminars. I didn't. Yeah, I was kind of
again.
I was kind of allergic to. Yeah.
Say that. Say that again. That's really important.
I didn't go to any seminars. I didn't pay for any networking events. I didn't. Honestly, I didn't even know what those were, and I didn't know which ones were good or which ones to trust. I just knew that if I met with people in Denver that I knew were successful, that I knew that that was going to work. And I felt like if I asked the right questions that they'd be willing to help me out. I think that, you know, the question comes up a lot, you know, like, how can you simulate that into other industries, or how can you do that today? And I think that people are willing to help other people when they know that they are serious and they like you and they trust you. I think when people like you and trust you, they're willing to like spend time and invest to help you when, regardless of what the industry is.
So I completely agree. So you said that you're serious and that they liked and trust you. So two things, I'm going to kind of divide these into things. So knowing you're serious, so you're getting business cards.
Right.
And number one, you're actually following up with the business cards, which, you know, a tip I learned from someone is like, basically don't bother going to an event unless you block out time afterwards to follow up with the people you met. And that's what obviously you did. You got 10 business cards, you contacted 10 people. But how did you over email, you know, the process of getting them to lunch and at lunch get to know that A, you were serious, and B, that they liked you?
Right. I think part of it just by nature is I'm a passionate person. So I was very engaged in the conversation. You know, fundamental, I think, you know, even the best, you know, going back to sports, the best basketball players in the world are just the ones that mastered the fundamentals the best. You know, everyone at that level can jump really high and run really fast. And I think it's the same thing in business. It's like, you have to master the fundamentals. So communication 101 is just looking someone in the eye, having eye contact, your body language, you know, all those things that are very elementary. I think I just did and showed up and did what I said. You know, when I went to lunch with someone and said I was going to pay for it, I paid for it. When I said I was going to email them, I emailed them. When I said I would show up at a house at 2 o'clock, I was there at 2 o'clock. I think it was very fundamental. I just did what I said I was going to do and I followed up. I also think that I found ways to make it mutually beneficial. You know, I tried to, empathy, I think, is a big factor in people and winning people and relationships. And I think, you know, when I showed up to a lunch, based on what industry or what side of real estate they were in, I tried to find a way that I could add value to them. So obviously if it's a realtor and I'm going to ask them to find properties for me. I'm trying to find a way that they can benefit, right? So I...
Can you give us an example of that? Because I understand conceptually, and that's something I preach all the time.
Right.
And that's how I've been able to kind of build a couple successful businesses. But what did you do specifically to make it not just a one-way street, but a two-way street?
100%. Yeah. At some point, like, people's goodwill runs out. They have to still be able to, you know, you have to be able to create value.
Yep.
And I think, you know, simply, you know, the low-hanging example is, if it was a realtor, I simply said, and we would structure a deal where if they brought me a deal that I closed on, that they would get the listing. And so then realtors were motivated to bring me properties because they knew that if I bought it, they were going to get a listing. So they were basically getting two transactions out of one. And I think to this day, I still work with three or four of those same people that have now become wholesalers and primarily just source properties for investors. And to this day, we still do a bunch of deals with them. And so what is that? Four or five years later, it's just because it's those same fundamentals. I did what we've always done, what we said we would do. And we've had clear communication. I think with title, you know, I remember there was several title companies that I would go to and they'd give me a list of foreclosures or people that were behind. And for them, it was, hey, if I can get this property or buy this property at auction, you're going to get the title policy or the title work. So it's, you know, the people that I was meeting with, I was trying to find ways that I could make it mutually beneficial.
Yeah.
And if I didn't think I could benefit them, I would just be honest. Like, hey, I don't know. Tell me how I could help you. Like, you're going to add value to me. How can I help you? I remember several lenders that gave me preferred terms or were able to close really quickly. You know, I obviously, besides just paying the note on time, you know, what are some other things? And I think over time, I was able to introduce them to other investors that then have been able to do business with them. So all along the way, I think real estate's a game of relationships. I think every industry is, but especially real estate. And it's a really small circle. So I think just focusing on doing what I'm saying I'm going to do and finding ways to add value to their business, to their core business, and just having empathy, showing up, putting yourself in the other person's shoes, I think is a massive way to build equity with someone.
So let's start talking about the real estate business that you and Brandon have built. So, you know, you're getting the ball rolling. You were learning while you were building and stuff. I don't even know where to start with the business you've done, but you've done single family flips. Kind of let's start there on what you've done, rough numbers.
Right.
Yeah, you know, how you built that business.
Yeah. So Brandon was in a transition in 2015. He was leaving another company that he had started and was looking for something fresh, something to do. Brandon and I were college teammates at Colorado Christian, and him and I had always talked about working together. I actually tried to hire him at OxyFresh. So we've always wanted to work together. I think one of the things there, same thing fundamental, like I know that I'm a visionary. I know that I can build relationships and trust really quickly. And I knew that he was a great operator. I knew he was very detailed, very good with numbers. He was also a realtor, and he could handle the accounting, the bookkeeping, which were things that I am not built to do. Yeah, I can do them, but I don't. That's not the highest and best use of my time. The highest and best use of my time, I knew, was going out, putting things together, creating opportunity, and then having someone next to me that could help make sure it's profitable and oversee the operations. And Brandon was that. So when Brandon was going through a transition, we decided, hey, let's try a few flips together, see how we like working together. So that was in 2015. We bought two or three homes and they went well. And we were like, hey, let's build this out. Let's do more. And since then, I think we've flipped probably 200 homes, probably close to 200 homes. I don't know the exact number, probably between 180 and 200 single family homes and duplexes and fourplexes. And then, so we scaled that. We basically just said, hey, here's three properties. It went well. Let's go buy five now. And then that went well. And we said, let's go buy 10.
I got to stop you there. You make it sound so simple, man. You're like, we bought three properties. We bought five. We bought 200. We scaled it. Right. Like, I know you, and I know like that's how you guys operate, but just like, you know, for the listener out there who wants to be in your shoes in 5 or 10 years, how do they find a GC? How do they find the deals? How do they not get upside down? Like,
right. So a little serendipity. My mom, as we talked before, was from Colombia. So I spent a lot of my childhood in South America. I learned Spanish. So that was a competitive advantage we had, which was one of the reasons we were able to scale so quickly. We found out that if I perfected my Spanish and practiced it more, we could get GCs that spoke fluent Spanish to do work faster and cheaper because we had a camaraderie. I'd built equity and rapport with them because I would speak their language. So that was one thing that maybe not be scalable, may or may not. If you can learn Spanish, I think that's a huge advantage. Like if you can dedicate yourself to learn Spanish, I think you will have a competitive advantage over a lot of people that are doing any kind of construction.
Or find a business partner that can.
So that's one thing that we have to put out there. I think, and we just had lunch with another group that was, you know, a family from LA that's in Denver now and wanting to flip properties. And I told them the same thing. I think that you put an ad on Craigslist and you try and find one trade that you can trust. I think you put an ad on Craigslist and you ask a realtor, you ask a title company, you ask a lender. Same thing I did starting out was I asked a bunch of different people, who do you trust? Even if you can just find a roofer, take that roofer to coffee, take him to lunch and say, who do you trust for drywall? Who do you trust to do tile? Who do you trust to do flooring? And then you start to build a team of people and you may have to GC it yourself first, right? And then as you build that and you know, you have people that you count on for flooring and you have paint and you have countertops and cabinets, but it just starts with finding one trade that you can trust and then asking them, hey, who do you like for this trade? Who do you like for this? And I think you have to, one thing I can't stress enough, you know, even my partners that did 600, you know, that operated and managed 600 flips to this day, right? We still practice these fundamentals. You have to show up at the job site every week. You have to be there. The number one way.
You're talking about you. As
I still show up there. Yeah. I mean, after as many as we've done and bought hundreds of apartments and all this stuff, I show up at the job site every week, multiple times a week. And if it's not me, it's someone on my team. You know, I can't be at every property every week now, but someone from our company is definitely there. We're taking pictures, we're taking videos. It still comes down to the fundamentals. People do what you inspect, not what you expect. You would expect if you pay someone that they're going to do the work, but that's not how it works. They're only going to do it if they know you're going to show up every week and check the trim, check the paint, check the tile, check the flooring, check that the HVAC was installed correctly, that the vents are there, that the electrical outlets are all have GFI. You have to inspect. And if it's not going to be you, it has to be someone on your team that's going and doing it. So that's, you know, the fundamentals. You have, you know, just little things that make a huge difference. If you don't show up at a job site for 4 weeks, and then you're scratching your head at why you're $20,000 over budget and why the GC hasn't been there, you have to show up. So I think that's one thing you have to, I mean, I would, to bring it down to practicality, find people you trust and ask them for a trade that they really trust. And then you build from there. Find one person, find an electrician you can trust. They're definitely going to know a plumber. They're definitely going to know someone for HVAC. They're going to probably know a roofer. They're going to know, you know, people that are good at what they do know other people that are good at what they do. You have to start with one.
Okay. And then how, I mean, just now since you've done, you know, roughly 200 flips here in Denver, just, you know, roughly like very rough percentages, what's your deal sources from wholesalers,
right,
from referrals, from realtors, from whatever? Like,
right,
kind of what's, where your deal sources come from?
So back in the day, let's start, you know, when we started in like my first deal that I was a part of in 2007, we bought it at auction. From 2008 to 2014, 95% of the deals that I was a part of were from a public trustee sale, either in Vegas, LA, Florida, anywhere. We're a public trustee sale. In Des Moines, Iowa, when we started buying there in 2016, 90% of the deals we were buying were from the Polk County Sheriff sale, all foreclosures. Since then, you know, since 2015, you know, we've had to evolve and it's become much more about relationships. Now that there's so many institutional buyers coming to Denver, right? We have buyers from Chicago, New York, California, Arizona, Vegas that have a lot of money. And institutional just means it's cheap. They have millions and millions and millions of dollars at a very low interest rate, that they are professional investors, right? When you say institutional, it just means they're professional investors, not like your grandpa that has $1 million or 100,000. These are people that have hundreds of millions of dollars and they're looking to deploy it and they can take a lower return because they have so much money that they need to invest. So that's who we were competing with. So we could not, that became no longer a source of properties. So it became doing the same thing. I started on bigger pockets. I started reaching out to people in Denver that were agents that worked with investors. I started, you know, I was still working with realtors that wanted to work with investors, and then wholesalers. We started doing the same thing, just building relationships with strategic people that could source opportunity for us. So realtors, people on bigger pockets, wholesalers. We started doing some door knocking. We would door knock specific neighborhoods or people that we got lists from title companies that were behind on their mortgage or that were in default of their payments and needed help. So we had to get creative. And you know, we had to really depend a lot more on relationships and our own ability to source opportunity.
And I just want to emphasize that because, I mean, I see a lot of people, they want to get the fix and flips and they're all, you know, talking about getting on every wholesaler's email list,
right,
or going out there and doing a bunch of their own direct mail marketing. And what I'm hearing from you is you have just repeated numerous times real estate and relationships.
Right.
Like, you didn't go out there and get every wholesaler's list. You went out there and built relationships with wholesalers, realtors, title companies,
right,
you know, people around the thing. And I think that's probably a big difference maker is you've been so relationship focused versus, you know, direct mail and email
right,
list focused.
Yeah. I know people that do that really well, that spend $25,000, $10,000, $50,000, any amount of money a month to get leads. And it works out. You know, you can go on BiggerPockets and listen to a bunch of podcasts from wholesalers that spend a ton of money, and that works out well for them. I've never, you know, that's been too risky for me. I've never felt comfortable spending 10, 20, any amount of money to then hopefully get things back in return. I feel like taking someone to lunch that has a track record and has an ability to go and source properties on the MLS, or that they're going to send mailers, or maybe they have their own database, or they have door knockers. That's always worked out better for me, is just building a relationship with someone that has access to opportunity and knowing that they're going to bring it to me when they have it, because they know that I'm going to perform, because they know that we're going to do what we say we're going to do. So there's 100 different ways to skin this cat. Whatever the appetite for risk is, you know, do that. I think the same fundamentals still apply. You still have to build relationships with someone, that, and you still have to follow up and do what you say you're going to do and execute on those fundamentals.
So, you know, something that's been interesting that we've talked about and observed in your business since, you know, we became friends earlier this year to now towards the end of 2018,
right,
is just, I don't know if it's a natural shift or a progression of your business, but you're going from single family homes and now more into focus of multifamily.
Right.
Just talk yeah, about that, because it's so intriguing.
Yeah. You know the numbers and the data better than I do. So you can probably speak to the data. You know, how many times do you hear people talk about, when's this bubble going to end? When's there going to be a correction in the market? I mean, since we started in this in 2008, people have been saying, when's the end coming? And you talk to 100 different people, you're going to get 100 different answers. I think that because of my experience of seeing the downturn and being able to buy 100 properties a year at auction and knowing how many people went into foreclosure, that's always been in the back of my mind. Like, this is a real thing. This can happen. This will happen again. So I think we've always been very sensitive to that, like watching the market very closely. And I think that as Denver has become more expensive, we always look at, if we can't sell this home, what's the worst case scenario? And, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, if we couldn't sell the home, we knew that we could rent it. We knew that, yeah, if we can't sell this home, we'll just refinance the hard money lender. We'll put it on a 30-year mortgage and we'll rent it, and maybe we'll clear $100, but we're still going to be making money and paying down the principal. Denver this year got to a place where we looked at the numbers and we could not rent them and make money.
Really? You saw that change this year from your perspective?
We saw it in June, July, and August. We said, hey, these deals do not make sense as a rental, so let's not buy it. And I think we got to September this year, interest rates were rising. I think there was some political things going on. And, you know, we saw the market pause. You know, at one point, and this was the first time this has happened in the last 4 years, we had 10, 11 properties on the market, and they were priced aggressively to sell. And at that point, I think, you know, Brandon and I looked at each other and said, okay, let's pause this. Let's reevaluate. Let's look at the numbers and, you know, let's look at what this means for us. So we haven't bought a single family home in Denver since August.
Really?
Since August of this year.
That.
Yeah. So since August of the year, we've not bought a single family property. The only properties we've closed on are actually Ozone deals that are, you know, it's a totally different business structure, which we can talk about later if the conversation leads us there. But we, you know, so then the conversation earlier this year came to, well, what do we do, right? What is the right pivot for us? Since we have these crews, we have these relationships that can source opportunity, you know, what's the right model? And thankfully, you know, we started buying multifamily in Des Moines, Iowa in 2016. And we've seen the power of buying apartments at scale. You know, we've seen the power of, you buy a 50-unit apartment building, even if it's half full, we're still able to cover the mortgage and it still cash flows. And so starting in 2016, you know, our mind started to go to, what would that look like to do that in Denver, right? What would it look like to do what we're doing in Des Moines and Denver, to buy apartments that had a lot of deferred maintenance, that were 30 or 40% under market rents, to buy those, to renovate every room just like we would renovate a home, right? Maybe use a lower level finish on flooring and cabinets and countertops, but same idea, right? We buy something that's been outdated, we update it, raise the rents and cash flow. What does that look like? So, you know, in 2017, I remember writing down my goals. 2018, it was like, I'm going to build relationships with commercial brokers that specialize in multifamily. And I wrote that down. You know, I had a vision board. I wrote it down. And so in 2018, I started emailing. Same thing I was doing in 2014 with residential brokers and hard money lenders and title companies was I was going to events, trying to intentionally meet these guys. I was online and I would Google, you know, who are the top apartment brokers in Denver? I'd look at the companies and I would try and find which ones were close to my age that I had things in common with. It was that simple. I was like, who are the guys that are my age in Denver that trade apartments that I would have something to add to the conversation? And I probably emailed 25, right? And to this day, you know, we work really closely with three or four of those same guys. And they've brought us, we've probably done four multifamily deals with these guys this year. And we're closing on our fifth at the end of December.
And so, I mean, it's the same recipe you did. You
right.
reached out,
right.
you followed up.
Yeah.
You built relationships,
you right.
bought lunch, you figured out how to yeah. bring value to the person right. and you just yeah. pivoted like that, huh?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when I was meeting with these guys, obviously in the current climate we were in, one thing that became evident to me was that the broker, you know, in the commercial world, what's different is that the commercial guys have all the power because the information is limited, right? I can go on Zillow and see what any home trades for in my neighborhood, but I can't go on Zillow and see what apartments are trading for. Right. So it's the commercial world. It is controlled by a smaller number of people because the information is limited on who owns it, how long they've owned it, you know, who's wanting to sell. So it's more sophisticated. So it's hard to get the information.
And it's also more relationship driven than
exactly. So that's what I learned is that I had to be able to provide value and create value and prove value much quicker. Like when I would go to lunch with a residential broker, they could just take me at face value that I was going to buy a home or that they could just, you know, at this level, you know, you had to prove that we have the capital that we can close. So, and they hold all the cards. They got to basically, you know, commercial brokers in a rising market like Denver, they have a lot of the leverage. They get to pick when someone calls them and says, we want to sell, they get to pick who they call first.
Oh yeah.
Cause it's not just on the MLS. Right.
And I'm curious though, did you like bring like a proof of funds yeah. to show the people like, hey, I'm like, I'm actually not just blowing smoke, but like
right.
we've got money and lenders lined up or?
So that's a great question. I think it was a combination. I didn't have to bring a proof of funds, but I definitely had to speak to our track record
yeah.
as far as being able to buy quickly, underwrite really quickly, and to be able to close, to perform. And so, you know, I think, you know, I'm reading Sam Zell's book right now. It's called Am I Being Too Subtle? And he has a line in there that I really relate with. And he says he realized early on in his career that speed and certainty were the value he created. And that was what I was able to communicate to these guys is I'm not going to be the highest paying client you have or the highest bid on any property you ever have, but I will be able to close quickly. I'll be able to underwrite quickly. And you know that we will close. We will perform. And so I've been able to articulate that story and that value proposition to guys that are, you know, they get paid on transactions. So being able to articulate something to someone that says, hey, I may not be able to pay the most for any property, but I will be able to give you an answer very quickly and I will be able to perform and being able to find the properties that worked for. Because not every seller is going to go for that, but being able to communicate that clearly. So I think being able to tell a story and articulate the value in a way that they can receive it. That was how I was able to build rapport with these guys in a short amount of time.
And that's where a lot of these apartments you bought came from?
That's where they all come from.
Really?
It's virtually impossible. I mean, it happens and people can do it, but mailing apartment owners will get you nowhere. Cold calling apartment owners will be very difficult. It is very relationship based. A lot of these families have dealt with the same companies and the same groups for 20, 30 years. Like they yeah. buy and sell from the same people, you know, because they want to go with people that they know that can perform as well. So it's a really tight knit community. So every apartment that we've bought in Denver has come from one of these guys, from these relationships. And yeah.
And I just want to reemphasize yeah. again, relationships. But that's one of the things I just think we talk about fundamentals
right.
and you do it and you do it repeatedly, which makes a big difference. Now, I've walked
one, two, three of your apartment right. projects in some stage or other, just because we've been hanging out or, you know, one time we were shooting videos, but I've gotten to see a few, which have been really cool. And one, the one you have off of near Colfax
right.
that I think you're probably okay. leasing up now.
Yeah.
I was there like the day you closed on, you had like a group of like 10 people right. around you. Project managers, right. GCs, roofers, right. the selling agent, like you're just, right. it was organized chaos. It was fun to see. I was just like a fly on the wall. But I got to see the evolution of like that, a property where it was to how the condition it was. And it
right.
was, I mean, talk about that property without giving out the right. address, but I think it was 15 units with dormitories downstairs.
Yeah. Right.
What are the details? Because I'm butchering them.
Yeah, we had bought a property right off Colfax. It was in a really cool area that we liked. It was kind of, it was transforming. I think they had put, the joke was they had just put a brand new Starbucks across the street. So we're like, you know, wherever they're putting brand new Starbucks, that's where we want to be. That's a good place to, that's a good place to invest. And yeah, the family had owned it for 30 years. They had a health related crisis and the family needed to close within 30 days. They had been under contract twice. And here we go. They just needed someone to perform. They needed someone to give them an answer quickly and perform. And at that point, the price was not the most important thing. The fact that we were $200,000 or $300,000 less than the previous offer did not matter as much as, hey, we just need someone who's going to close. And since I had articulated this is what we're looking for, they knew to call us first. They said, hey, here's a deal. You just need to be able to close and we can come in at this number and it still makes sense for you to be able to come in, renovate, and be able to stabilize and have the return that you're looking for.
Because the place, I recall, I mean, it wasn't in great shape, but it wasn't horrible, but it was just severely under-rented.
Right.
Right? That was like, I mean, you had places around for like $200 or $300
yes,
or something like
that.
They
had some sleeping
right?
rooms. I think in the basement, they had five sleeping rooms that were going for like $100 and $200 a night. People had been living there for 10, 15 years. Rent hadn't increased. I mean, there's people paying for a 2-1. And you're right, it was just outdated. They were paying like $500 or $600 for 2-1, which in core Denver is 50% of market or less.
Yeah, I mean, that's just unheard of.
Right. There was, yeah, I mean, like the roof needed to be changed, all new windows, we did all new cabinets, but it was definitely livable. It, you know, I think it had some pest control issues and it had just been, you know, mismanaged. It was one of those things where the family had passed it down several generations and the current owners just didn't know how to manage it correctly.
And now since you, I mean, I think probably about a month or two ago, you finished that rehab and that was, I think you took those sleeping rooms. It's 18
units. Yeah, it's 18 units now.
So you have 18 units now. And as you call it, you kind of took it through your assembly line, which is
right.
you've got your appliances, your colors, your tiles,
right.
you've got everything. It's just boom, 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 boom. So doing 18 units on there, any major differences scaling from doing lots of single family homes
right.
to then doing apartments? Like, what was the same? What was not the same?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of similarities were the products like you talked about. We have an assembly line. We try and use the same paint, same flooring, same cabinets, same countertops, same subway tile, you know, all the same fixtures. So that was the same. I think, you know, anytime you're doing 18 kitchens, 18 bathrooms, you know, obviously the plumbing, you know, everything was just magnified that much more. Like the plumbing, we had to spend that much more time clearing all the lines. The electrical, we had to redo 18 panels. You know, the HVAC was just one boiler system. We had to clean it. We had to repair the vents in every unit. So that was the biggest renovation we had done in Denver to date. Since then, we've done a 22 unit and we're in the process of doing a 20. We're in the process of taking down a 23 unit. But, you know, the thing that I've learned this year is we have to plan. You have to plan with the GC that much more. Like on a single family home, you can, you know, if you're behind a week or two on windows, that's fine. Like on these, when we at one point we were waiting on an order of cabinets for like 4 weeks. Well, that put the project back 8 weeks, right? Because they couldn't do the, you know, we were waiting on the cabinets, so then they couldn't do the countertops and they couldn't install appliances, they couldn't install the backsplash.
So it was a domino effect.
It was a domino, exactly.
Then, huh?
So now instead of being just back 4 weeks, we're back 8 weeks. And I think we ended up being 10 weeks behind, which is the most we've ever been behind. If you talk to anyone in commercial construction, they would say 12 weeks is nothing. But for me, being 12 days behind was a massive issue, you know, because in single family, you plan when you're going to list based on the seasonality. So I think part of the learning lesson this year was, you know, we have to be much more intentional about planning, really being careful about where we're sourcing our materials from, making sure that's on a tight schedule. So little nuances like that. I mean, macro level, I think it all applied. I think the micro, every single trade matters so much more to be on schedule. And you have to really plan everything out, every phase of construction out with your GC.
And, you know, I was thinking, I know I mentioned, you know, I looked at a few properties, did some videos with you, and as you were talking about, I just remember the numerous times I've been there, and that was actually to kind of change the subject and give a plug for a new project that you and I are working on. We actually walked that property in the first episode right. of a new series yeah. that we're in the process of launching. We're hitting a few curveballs here, but we're in the process of launching. We'll get out eventually, but it's called the Denver Real Estate Ride Along Show. Right. And this was an idea you had. I think we started talking, I mean, what, about 4 months ago on
right.
there.
Right.
Kind of yeah. give everyone the vision you had on that. We'll talk about that for a few yeah. minutes.
So how that came about was I would talk to friends and family and they would ask, you know, what are you working on? How's it going? And it's difficult to articulate, you know, we have 12 flips going, we have an apartment complex, or we're working on this, you know, opportunity, you know, it became difficult to really paint an accurate picture. So in 2016, one of our investors was like, hey, I want to spend the day with you. And we spent 8 hours. We drove every property we had going in Denver. And at the end, the next day, he sent me an email and it was just very encouraging, you know, with saying how impressed he was with what we were working on. And he had no idea the scale of the operation, no idea, you know, how, you know, basically just gave us a bunch of compliments, really impressed. And I think he ended up investing more money with us. And that wasn't the point of the ride along. He just wanted to see how things were going. And that happened like two or three more times over the course of the next 2 years. So that the first one I think I did was in 2016. And even, you know, how we got in the opportunity zone was a couple of institutional guys said, hey, I want to spend the day with you and see what you're doing. And then they ended up saying, hey, let's do this opportunity zone thing together. So it bore a lot of fruit. Every time I spent the day with someone that was not in real estate, it ended up like having great results. So then, you know, midway through the year, I was like, we should let everyone spend a day with us and we should just put it on camera and put it out there on Facebook and Instagram and see what kind of relationships and opportunities we can build. And that was really it. It was that simple that I think when people spend a day and see what we're working on and see the opportunities, see the deals, hear the background, and when they're able to ask questions, it creates opportunity. And so we're basically just, we're going to spend three or four hours with someone that's not in real estate. We're going to fly them to Denver. They can ask any question they want. They're going to go see live projects. They're going to be able to see different phases of construction around the city. And they're going to be able to learn real estate, you know, basically A to Z in 3 or 4 hours. And then we're going to video the whole thing and we're going to be able to edit it and publish it. And hopefully it'll add a lot of value to people out there that are interested in real estate. And, you know, hopefully it'll open some doors with some people that are doing real estate that maybe have some new ideas for us or that want to partner on something in Denver.
Yeah. And like I said, before we hit record this, we're actually talking how to get over a few speed bumps we have right now, but they'll probably be like, we're thinking now 15 or 20 minute long episodes are cut down from, you know, 4 hours of content, which is just a cameraman following us around for 4 hours. Right. Then we edit it down. We'll probably put it on YouTube and IGTV. If the link is ready for it, by the time we publish this podcast in the show notes, otherwise email me.
Yeah.
You can follow Terrence on Instagram. What's your handle?
At Terrence Doyle, TERRANCE. Doyle, DOYLE.
And I'm going to put a plug out there because, you know, Terrence and I were talking about relationships on kind of creating win-win situations. And, you know, we've created that. We found a great camera person that's working with us
right.
and she wants to run real estate. But a hurdle we currently have is we have gone through unsuccessfully a couple of editors and we're trying to find some editors out there. So if anyone out there has interest or ability in editing and you are willing to do some work with us, meet some neat people, work on some projects, get a lot of behind the scene access, and you can do video editing and you commit to some projects, definitely reach out to me, chris@denverinvestmentrealestate.com. Email me. That is something we're currently working for. We're talking to a couple people next week. But if there's also anything else, you guys watch that show or you guys know video production and you see value that you can add, reach out to us. We want to make this like a collaborative experience to where we can produce some really cool content, but also make it a win-win-win for the people that are also helping us put the show together. So I know, oh gosh, there's so much more to talk about, Terrence, and we don't have too much longer left to discuss here. But something else we did on the second episode of the Ride Along, which we'll get out eventually as well, is we actually stopped by your very first Opportunity Zone investment. And as far as, like I also said in the beginning, like it's actually everyone's talking about Opportunity Zones. A lot of people are talking about getting funds together.
Right.
A lot of people are talking. You're doing on that.
Right.
And it's so cool. So what can you share about this project location-wise, what you're doing, and just very rough numbers? And if you guys don't know what Opportunity Zones are, go back probably about 10 episodes and see one that says Opportunity Zones. Listen to it. it is going to be an hour full of new stuff that's happening in the tax code. So what are you doing with this project?
Yeah, just to reiterate, I mean, I had a friend introduce me to the Opportunity Zone, the concept and the tax strategy behind it in March of this year. And so since March, it's just been a full court press as far as trying to digest all the content out there. We've talked to 20 different accountants and CPAs on how to structure it, different attorneys, very complex. I think that it's maybe the most massive real estate incentive that the government's ever published. I mean, it is, you know, and we could probably do another podcast just on what I've learned since we recorded the first podcast in Opportunity Zones. I think anyone listening, you should Google Opportunity Zones and go read up on it. If you have unrealized gains in the stock market, if you have a business that you're in the process of selling, if you have real estate you're in the process of selling, you should look at Opportunity Zones. It is a massive opportunity, and it's actually, it's significantly superior to a 1031 exchange. So if you're in the 1031 world, you should go look at Opportunity Zones. It is significantly better in so many ways. And you can go back to the podcast to read up on the details of why it's better. So in the Opportunity Zone, the first property we took down, I believe it was 2 months ago, we took down three lots. One of them had a home on it, which we're currently renovating as a rental. And then the other two lots are zoned for duplexes. And so we are in the process of getting permits, and we are in the process of building modular duplexes on those, and they're being built in a factory in Nebraska.
So let me pause here for a second. I want to paint the picture because I saw this property, and I mean, so it's a house.
Right.
And I mean, when it's a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house with
a basement.
It's going
to be a 4-bedroom, 2-bathroom house with a basement, and it was built 100 years ago, and it's in Swansea. It's right off I-70. Right in the heart of the Opportunity Zone there.
And then so you got the house, and then there's an empty lot on the right, an empty lot on the left.
Yes.
And you're putting a duplex on each one of those lots,
yes.
Right? And it kind of is very interesting. Like, I mean, you know, after you've pointed out to me, I said, well, that's a perfect place to do it because, like, I didn't see any other houses in the neighborhood where there was an empty lot
right.
on either side of it.
Right.
And it seems like you got a great, great project here. So house you're renovating and just going to turn into a rental.
Right.
And then two modular duplexes. Why are you doing modular? Is it just speed and cost effectiveness?
Yeah. So I think modular has a negative connotation, but it simply means it's being built in a factory as opposed to on site. And we're able to build roughly 30 or 40% cheaper. It's going to come out to around $90 a square foot as opposed to some of the bids we received to build it on site in the 130 to 150 range. So it's cheaper, it's faster, it only takes 8 weeks. It's more scalable since we wanted—
It's 8 weeks?
8 weeks from the time that we press play, it'll be built in eight— They will be built and shipped, and I think they'll be on site in 10 weeks from the time that we have the permit.
Yeah.
So we have to go through the permitting process still. Yeah, they're built in the factory. They claim they can do them in 6 weeks, but we're being conservative saying 8 weeks and then 10 weeks on the site. Yeah. So faster, cheaper, I think more scalable. The weather doesn't play a factor. I mean, they can hammer away. They have people working on them in a factory, literally as an assembly line. They're building them and they work around the clock. So it was something we've been wanting to do something like that in Denver for a while because we had several different modular relationships. And it just happened to be that with the Opportunity Zone, it was the perfect storm where this made sense to develop. You know, most people say, why would you be developing at this time of the cycle? Everything's inflated. But with the tax advantages and with where we're able to buy the lots, right? Because we're buying them in low-income areas where you can buy the land at a significantly more affordable price than other areas in Denver. It all came together and all made sense.
Well, plus, I mean, this is a, you know, opportunity. It's a 10-year play where you're holding a property.
Exactly.
You're not buying it, spending 3 years building it and trying to sell high-end properties in the market. You're going to hold on to it and— I mean, if you own the property for 10 years in real estate, it's really, really, really hard not to make money over a 10-year time frame.
Yeah, to your point, I mean, the same thing we noticed this year in single family, we're planning to rent it. So as long as it cash flows, so we're building something that is going to cash flow, which is one of the other reasons why we're able to go modular was your cost basis is lower. So now your rents, even if we have, let's say, a mass exodus in Denver and we have, you know, rents drop by 20%, it would still cash flow. So yeah, we're building something that can cash flow for 10 years and it is a long-term play.
All right, so something else we got a few minutes left. So something else I want to actually have you talk about is, again, before we hit record on this, we were just kind of catching up and talking about things. And you were talking about how you were getting a house for some family members in Cherry Creek. Just kind of, and you know, we're recording this early December 2018. If you listen to my other podcasts, other webinars, I've been basically subtly yelling at buyers out there, whether you're my buyer or you're a buyer with another real estate agent, like, hey, this is the best window in recent memory in Denver to be a buyer. And so far, you take the cake for the best deal I've heard up to date. So run us through the numbers on this.
Yeah, anyone listening out of state that's looking at rentals or anything that cash flows or wants to be a part of the Denver real estate investing family, I mean, I've been saying the same thing the last two or three months. As I've seen us have to drop our prices on flips and homes that we're selling, I've been telling other people now's the time to be getting in, specifically over $500,000. And it's very simple, just a function of what people can afford. There's not enough high-paying W-2 jobs in Denver to support the number of homes that are for sale over $500,000. So what do they have to do? Everybody starts dropping. And yeah, I've been looking for my in-laws. My wife and I live in Congress Park near Cherry Creek, and my in-laws love Cherry Creek. They currently live out of state, and we have an 8-month-old daughter, so we're trying to convince them to come. You know the drill. You have a young one at home. Anyone out there that has a young one at home, they probably know the same thing. You're trying to recruit family members to Denver. We don't want to leave. They live in Pittsburgh. We're not trying to go to Pittsburgh. We're trying to recruit them here. So I've been looking for property, you know, for them to come and live in. So if I drew a circle around all the available properties in Cherry Creek, and there's probably 20 properties all around $1 million for sale, and they're just sitting there dropping every two or three weeks, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. And I would call the agents and just say, hey, tell me the situation. What's going on? Like, how motivated are these sellers? What, you know, are you seeing any action? Do you have any offers? So there's one particular townhome. I walked it. It was outdated. It was roughly 3,600 square feet. I called the agent. I said, hey, tell me about this property. You know, it's been sitting here for a couple months. And she went on to tell me the story about how these sellers were in a little bit of a crisis. They need to close it before the end of the year, and that they were highly motivated. And I said, hey, if something happens, I think it was priced at the time in the mid nines. And I said, if something happens, let me know. I think there's a fair amount of work to do. We'd need to reconfigure for my in-laws, and they'd want things updated and, you know, this and that. And I kind of told her the truth, like, here's what we would need to put into it. So I'm not a buyer at this price, but if something changes, let me know. And she said, yeah, no problem. So her and I would talk every 10 days, and it went under contract. And she called me and said, hey, do you want to put in an offer? It's under contract. I said, yeah, they're probably a lot higher. We can't match it. Go ahead. And probably 3 weeks later, she calls me out of the blue and says, hey, the buyers fell out of contract. They terminated based on some financing issues. Who knows if that's really what happened, but that was what she said. I'm thinking it was probably something more to do with the inspection, and it was going to cost more than they thought to renovate it. Needless to say, a property that one time was on the market for in the mid nines, we have in the mid sixes. And it's 3,600 square feet in the heart of Cherry Creek. My in-laws will love it. And the best part about it is if we can't sell it or don't want to sell it, we can rent it out and it'll cash flow. So I think that there's numerous properties like this all around Denver. If you look at Wash Park, a bunch of properties sitting on the market that are, you know, well over $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, $900,000. Hilltop, same thing. Capitol Hill. I mean, there's pockets of Denver that where there's, you know, developers or flippers that bought in April, May, or maybe even last year and started flipping or doing a pop top. And now they're sitting, you know, and it's been sitting for 6 months and there's just not enough people that can afford it. And there's creative things you can do. You can Airbnb, you can separate it into a duplex. You can move your in-laws across the country. I mean, there's so many ways to buy value right now. If you have cash and you want to invest in Denver, I mean, you can, I mean, what is that? A 40% discount, 35% discount. I mean, there's massive discounts at the higher price point because there's just not enough buyers.
Now, I mean, just to recap those numbers, I mean, yeah, I mean, so I'm looking at the MLS sheet right now. It was listed in October and yeah, in the mid 900,000s. They dropped at some point to 900,000. You got it now in the mid sixes. So yeah, I mean, that's, I mean, a $300,000-ish dollar price drop, which is just insane to me. Now, granted, that's future events. Now, we're not seeing that in a lot of the stuff we're buying for house hackers and, you know, traditional rentals and the lower end selling things, you know, that big of a spread. But we're seeing similar stuff right now. So I'll reiterate what Terrence said. And if you're looking at a house hacker, look to invest, like, hey, and if you're, this time frame meets up for you, definitely do it.
Massive
opportunity.
I'm not
just saying that me as a client. If you're working with another agent, get out there and do it too, because it's a great time.
Massive opportunity right now, yeah.
All right, Terrence, so we are just about at an hour here, and I could spend another hour with you, but we'll definitely have it back on to talk more about opportunity zones, more about what your business is doing. Oh, actually, I got one more question I want to ask you before we do wrap up. Knowing what you know now, if you could go back in a time machine 10 years, what would you tell your younger newbie self for advice?
2008. Man, that seems like a long ways away. 2008, I think, you know, the punchline is buy and hold. You know, we were buying and flipping. If we would have held those 600 properties, I'd probably be on a yacht somewhere in the Bahamas. You know, I'd probably still be working, but I probably wouldn't be in Denver where it's 30 degrees, you know? So I think, you know, buy and hold. You can't, you know, if you're buying at the bottom, like we were, obviously we didn't know that. And I think, you know, just continue to master the fundamentals, you know, something I've preached since days of playing basketball, you know, and then it was being able to dribble and make a chest pass. And now it's being able to communicate and follow up and follow through, really. Communicate, follow up, follow through. No matter what industry you're in or what your specification is in real estate, you know, what your passion is in real estate, if you do those things with people, I think you're going to have massive success over the long haul, you know?
Well, that is great advice. So just to kind of recap a few things, so we'll definitely have you back on and talk about, I mean, some of the interesting projects you're doing on the bigger multifamily, how you're structuring the numbers, because it's so interesting. We'll talk opportunity zones. And guys, definitely check out the Denver Real Estate Ride-Along Show. We will get it published.
Yeah.
And
sooner or later, it'll be out.
And hopefully on the sooner side, we're making it happen. But I really think it's going to be something unique. Like, I mean, I haven't seen anything else quite like it out there. So we're trying to do something fun, something creative, and something where it's not tied to the back end that we're upselling you to a major seminar or conference. We just want to provide value, network virtually, meet more people. And that way we can all, you know, just kind of grow the pie bigger and it's better for everyone. So be on the lookout for that. But Terrence, man, just thank you so much. I appreciate you coming out.
Thanks a lot for having me. I hope that this was valuable and some people can really take those fundamental principles and apply them and go build relationships and create opportunity for whatever aspect of real estate they want to get into. So I hope it was beneficial for the audience.
And I think the best way for people to get a hold of you is just to probably DM you on Instagram, right?
Instagram. You can look at my Instagram at Terrence Doyle. You can email me Terrence, Terrance@gmail.com, and I'm happy to grab coffee, happy to answer any questions and help anyone any way that we can.
And I'll put those links in the show notes. All right. Thank you, Terrence.
Thanks a lot, Chris.